Hey kids, I'd like to introduce you to a new podcast you're going to love. On behalf of myself, Morgan Rector, of one of the most horrific true crime podcasts, Human Monsters, I'd like to ask you this question. Do you like to travel? Do you like picturesque locations and getting away from it all? Fun fact, there is a morgue on every cruise ship. After all, people die everywhere. Why wouldn't they die on a cruise ship in the Bahamas? Well, this new podcast has all that and murder. It's called Slaycation, and it's a darkly humorous look at murders and mysterious deaths that took place on vacation. Hosted by true crime fanatic, her comedy writer husband, and his TV producing partner, Slaycation brings a unique perspective to chilling, thrilling, and what-the-fuck stories of vacations gone horribly wrong. From the twisted tale of Harold and Tony Henthorne, whose romantic anniversary in the Rocky Mountains ended with one of them falling off a cliff, to Angelica and Vincent, two recently engaged lovebirds whose Hudson Valley kayaking adventure ended underwater. Each episode of Slaycation will have you asking, accident or murder? But it's not just the stories that'll intrigue you. It's the discussion between a longtime married couple and business partners who happen to be Emmy-nominated TV producers. Each episode of Slaycation also includes humor, takeaway, and travel tips that will keep your next vacation from being your last. If you're ready to pack your body bags, Slaycation is available on all major podcast platforms. Search for Slaycation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Imagine unlocking a version of yourself that's unstoppable, where mental barriers no longer hold you back. Listen to Mentally Stronger with me, Amy Morin, therapist and international bestselling author, here to guide you on a journey to reaching your greatest potential. Every Monday, I bring you into conversations with some of the most fascinating minds, experts, authors, entrepreneurs, athletes, and musicians. They don't just share stories, they reveal the mental strategies that propelled them to the top. But here's the real magic. At the end of each episode, I break down their wisdom into practical therapist-approved advice. In my solo episodes, I dive deep into the techniques that build mental strength. It's like having your own personal therapy session as you discover how to turn these insights into steps you can take right now. This podcast isn't just for those facing mental health challenges. It's for anyone who wants to push their limits, achieve peak performance, and truly thrive. Are you ready to unlock your full potential? Then it's time to become mentally stronger. Subscribe to Mentally Stronger with therapist Amy Morin, available wherever you love to listen to podcasts.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Hey, Humo soldiers. Some of you are interested in scoring some Humo merch, like t-shirts and hoodies, but you don't want to wait to win a contest to get it. I get it. I have now set up an online store if you want to purchase one of those items. Check the liner notes for this episode to get the link. Thank you again to those of you who have joined Supporting Cast, the Apple subscription option, and the Patreon. The Patreon link is www.patreon.com/leaderone, LEADERONE. Like with Supporting Cast and the Apple subscription, Patreon donors will get early releases, bonus episodes, and an entry in the monthly draws for merch. Remember, there is no minimum donation for the Patreon. If a dollar is all you can swing, it would be greatly appreciated. Thank you so much for listening and for your support. Available on Amazon Prime.
That was the last time you saw your entire family before tonight?
Janine! Hey, baby girl.
Hi, Doc.
You any domestic problems, Josiah? Kids have any problems at school? Neighbors?
We're just a happy suburban family.
Whisper! All right. You got the American dream, and I delivered it to you.
But Whisper? He's reckless.
More money, more money.
Did you murder your family?
We're gonna turn this thing inside out until we learn the truth.
What if they find out?
Man, you seriously got a problem with me.
They're coming for me next. I'm not gonna let them do it. Stop shooting.
American Whisper, a true crime docudrama, available on Amazon Prime. Welcome to Human Monsters. Harold Frederick Shipman was born on January 14, 1946, in Nottingham, England. He was the second child of Vera and Harold Sr. They took to calling their son Freddie, as did many of his future friends and colleagues. Years later, he would be dubbed Dr. Death and the Angel of Death by the media. He had an older sister and younger brother. Freddie was his mother's favorite, considered as he was by her to be the most intelligent of her children and having the most potential. She micromanaged her children's lives to the point where she was exacting when it came to their wardrobe. Freddie was required to wear a tie to school. By doing so, his mother inculcated into him a superiority complex. This attitude didn't exactly make him popular at school. One crucially pivotal event in Harold's life was the illness and untimely demise of his mother in his teens. She was stricken with lung cancer. Harold would take care of her as much as he could. He would hurry home from school so that he could be at her side, something she appreciated deeply. The highlight of her day was when Harold came to her bedside. It was this experience that enabled him to develop the bedside manner that would endear him to patients as he embarked on his career in medicine years later. Another aspect of this experience that deeply affected him was when his mother's physician administered morphine to alleviate her pain. Ignorant of the science behind it, to young Harold, it came across as a miracle drug. It would factor into his future in ways that not even he could have envisioned at the time. Seeing his mother suffer and watching a physician relieving her of her pain played an instrumental role in inspiring him to become a doctor. Vera died on June 21, 1963. From that date forward, Harold Shipman would dedicate his life to becoming a practitioner of medicine. 1965. Harold Shipman married a girl named Primrose. He was 19, she 17. They both had controlling mothers, which was one of the factors that brought them together. They had a child the first year of their marriage. They would go on to have three others. They remained together for the rest of his life. Shipman was accepted into medical school in 1965, though not with his first attempt. This is not so hard to understand if you have met anybody who has applied to medical school. First, you have to ace a course called organic chemistry. Whether or not you were an academic star beforehand, this course definitely separates the wheat from the chaff in terms of weeding out those who are not capable of understanding such complicated principles of science and math. Shipman may have failed the entrance exam the first time around, but he was undaunted and persistent, and he was accepted with his second try into the University of Leeds medical program in September 1965. Medical school was no cakewalk for him, and he had to push very hard to pass his courses. June 1970. Harold Shipman, 24 years old, graduated from medical school. He was eager to begin his career. Shipman began as a house officer, or what is referred to in North America as a resident. Every graduate is required to complete this probationary period in order to become a fully licensed physician. He served as house officer in Pontefract General Infirmary in West Riding in the county of Yorkshire. 1 year later, he became a certified doctor, registered with the General Medical Council. He spent 3 more years as a senior house officer. During that time, he upgraded his medical education, getting diplomas in pediatrics, obstetrics, and gynecology. 1974. Shipman responded to an ad in a medical periodical advertising a position at the Abraham Ormerod Medical Center in West Yorkshire. Following a period when he served as an assistant general practitioner, he was promoted to junior partner. He was considered an asset to the institution because of being a recent medical school graduate who was up to date on the most modern medical treatments. He delivered on that front, even going so far as to make recommendations for updating the record-keeping system. Shipman underwent a significant shift in his demeanor at this time. The man who at one time had been reserved and kept to himself was now outgoing with his colleagues and enjoyed as much respect on a personal level as he did as a medical professional. Nurses and other staff saw a considerably uglier side of him. If somebody disagreed with the way he wanted things done, he could be abrasive and insulting. He would even go as far as to call someone stupid. He still had a superiority complex, but he mostly kept it to himself in the presence of patients and anyone who held the reins of power. It was not something most doctors would bother themselves with, but Harold Shipman became deeply involved with the pharmaceutical inventory. He would ensure that expired drugs were removed and restocked in a timely fashion. It is a very necessary procedure, but one that the staff pharmacists would normally attend to. Up to this point, Dr. Shipman's record as a medical practitioner was free of blemishes. But there was one early blip in February 1975. The Home Office Drugs Inspectorate, a department of the government, and the West Yorkshire Police Drug Squad announced an investigation of some drug-related matters at the hospital. Shipman had been placing unusually large orders of pethidine, a synthetic opiate similar in effect to the morphine that was administered to his mother to relieve her of her suffering. Pethidine was one of the most prescribed painkillers late in the 20th century. The authorities were concerned that Shipman might be addicted to pethidine or that he might be selling them illicitly. When they approached the facility's pharmacy, they were told by staff that Shipman was a highly regarded physician, or, in their words, efficient and confident. They were so convinced Shipman was as ethical as he was competent that the authorities were also convinced, and the investigation was closed. In May 1975, Shipman experienced a blackout in his bathroom at home. He hit his head on the sink on the way down. He had other blackouts, and when he was referred to a neurologist, he was diagnosed with idiopathic epilepsy, meaning the cause of his seizures was unknown. He relied on his wife to drive him to work and to house calls from that point onwards. Shipman continued to order what were considered to be excessive amounts of pethidine. The police and the Home Office interviewed him in June 1975. Shipman convinced them that the quantities were medically necessary and nothing untoward was afoot. There was one area of concern. The records Shipman kept on the details of his use of pethidine on patients were often incomplete. Some of the inventory logs were also left incomplete, which further complicated investigations. The Home Office dispatched an advisor to provide counsel on appropriate record keeping and disposal of expired pharmaceuticals. This was not the end of the inquiry for the firm, however. The top brass summoned him to a meeting, whereupon they presented him with the evidence of his abuse of pethidine. He admitted to using the drug beyond the parameters of medical treatment. He used his charm and friendships with his colleagues in an attempt to persuade them to allow him to hide his addiction while enabling it by allocating a quantity to him for his own private use. He must have been high when he made this ridiculous proposal. Naturally, they rejected it. His reaction was to go on a tirade, resign, withdraw his resignation, and tell the partners they would have to force him out before he stormed out of the room. If he had once been perceived as a pillar of mental stability, his colleagues watched it crumble before their eyes. Primrose did the same sometime later, telling the partners that Harold would not leave voluntarily. This threat was prescient. After consulting with their legal representation, the firm voted unanimously to have Harold Shipman removed from the practice. They followed up by notifying the police of Harold Shipman's illegal handling of pethidine. November 28, 1975. The police interviewed Dr. Harold Shipman about his abuse of pethidine. He voluntarily registered in a drug rehab program called The Retreat. It was there where he was interviewed by police. At first, he denied that he was guilty as charged, but he soon confessed. He told them he started taking it in May 1974 as a treatment for depression, which became an issue due to the fact that he had difficulty getting along with his colleagues. That was his story. This came as a surprise to his co-workers and collaborators, who recall having cordial and fruitful professional and personal relationships with Shipman. I took a similar medication for pain, and I can attest to its powers as an antidepressant. Unlike Prozac or Paxil, opioids actually make you feel happy, but I wasn't about to use them recreationally for a concern that I, too, would have become addicted. One officer who interviewed Shipman noticed that all his visible veins had collapsed, typically a symptom of intravenous drug use. The implication was that he had likely been injecting pethidine for years, possibly even going back to his days as a house officer, though this part of his history was not investigated. Shipman wrote a statement confessing to the methods by which he acquired pethidine and the fact that he became addicted. He noted that he would not return to medical practice in an environment where he would have access to pethidine. He was discharged from the retreat on December 30th. It was recommended that he undergo psychoanalysis for a few years. His seizures stopped, and he realized in March 1976 that they were caused by his abuse of pethidine. He began to drive again. February 13, 1976. Harold Shipman reported to a session at Halifax Magistrates Court. He received three charges of obtaining 10 ampoules of 100 milligram pethidine by deception, three charges of illegal possession of pethidine, and one charge of forging a prescription, his usual way of obtaining the drug. He pled guilty. He was convicted but did not do time. He paid a total of £600 in fines. Preceding Shipman's day in court, on February 2nd, Shipman began working at Newton Aycliffe Health Center as a clinical medical officer. Though his new employers were aware of his legal troubles, they consulted with his psychiatrists, who assured them Shipman would make an exemplary employee and would not abuse his access to prescription painkillers. The GMC accepted that he had learned his lesson and did not move to discipline him, though they did warn him that any future transgressions along those lines would result in his license being called into review. He was also fortunate in that his actions had not caused harm to his patients, a point of which the police took note. Shipman continued working for the Durham Area Medical Authority, while also taking up a temporary position with the National Coal Board. 1977. Shipman responded to a want ad for a position as a general practitioner at the Donnybrook practice in the town of Hyde. The screening process involved an assurance that Shipman was not abusing drugs of any kind and that neither addiction nor mental health issues would interfere with his ability to treat patients. He was under no restrictions when it came to handling and administering certain medications. With this established, he began working at Donnybrook on October 1st. This new phase brought some much-needed prestige to Harold Shipman's reputation. He was instrumental in bringing new medical innovations on board. He also became an area surgeon for the local St. John Ambulance, a member of the local practitioners committee, and a secretary position with the Thameside Local Medical Committee. He was also a crusader for preventative medicine, insisting upon regular checkups for patients, whether they were feeling ill or not. He still made house calls, often unannounced, just to check up on patients. He showed real personal interest not just in their health, but in their lives in general, and he was highly regarded by his patients as a result. With his colleagues and other medical staff, he wasn't always so magnanimous. He demanded that things be done his way, and by doing so, frequently alienated himself from his staff. 1991. Harold Shipman decided to leave the Donnybrook practice. The facility embraced computer technology in 1989, and he disliked the computers with which he cataloged the clerical side of his work. He was also opposed to the ways in which his partners proposed to institute the system of fund holding. This referred to a new government policy which allowed hospitals and other medical facilities to determine their own budgets drawn from the public purse. Strangely, Shipman would go on to both embrace computers for record keeping and become enthusiastic about the freedom of arranging a budget according to the needs of the medical firm. Perhaps this change of heart was due to his decision to go into private practice. He would certainly have less people to argue with, and he certainly didn't want to bother himself with constant quarrels with the government over funding. For such a secretive doctor, going into a self-administered practice would be ideal.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom
was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. Okay. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene...
There were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Hi, I'm Karina Bemisdorfer, host of Morning Cup of Murder, your daily true crime podcast. Yes, you heard me right. Daily true crime. Every day, Morning Cup of Murder tells you a straightforward, short-form story about murder, true crime, cold cases, disappearances, serial killers, cults, and more. And I do that all in under 15 minutes. With over 3 years of stories and over 20 million downloads, the Morning Cup of Murder podcast has become a staple of so many people's daily routines. So, why not add it to yours? Stream Morning Cup of Murder everywhere you listen to podcasts, and remember, stay safe.
January 1st, 1992. Shipman began treating patients at his private practice. He still practiced surgical procedures at Donnybrook. He took with him a number of patients that he had been treating at Donnybrook, and the patients did not object because they were so fond of his bedside manner. Elderly patients were especially fond of him because of his willingness to make house calls. He took an interest in their lives, and considering that loneliness is an affliction faced by many seniors, that, too, was appreciated. He came across like he really cared, and they were touched. Shipman's reputation among patients led to an increasing pool of patients, and his popularity grew through word of mouth. There were people who were put on waiting lists because having Harold Shipman as your general practitioner was considered to be a stroke of good fortune. Indeed, one such patient likened it to winning the lottery. At one point, he brought in a partner so that he could administer to the ever-growing list of patients. Shipman's reputation with medical authorities underwent an effective spit shine. He became a go-to consultant when the health authorities' audit group needed someone to advise them on how to conduct an audit of private practices. He became involved in a political branch of medicine, becoming the treasurer of the local branch of the Small Practices Association. He was soon regarded as the best doctor in Hyde. Harold Shipman made a habit of advising families of deceased patients to cremate their loved ones. Whatever explanation he gave them, he didn't mention that murdering patients with your own method of lethal injection can be effectively concealed when the body is reduced to ashes. An autopsy on a corpse left to rot for several months can still provide valuable intel on the cause of death. Nothing can survive cremation. Everything, down to every last molecule of DNA at the cellular level, is burned beyond oblivion. You can find traces of opiates in the blood of a corpse, but opiates are as flammable as any part of the human body. Another way to eliminate all records of, say, an overdose by opiates is to enter false data while you're filling out the death certificate. A second doctor was called in as standard procedure. They were to fill out Form C after conferring with the doctor who fills in Form B. Their charge was to examine the body, speak with the other physician, and sign the paperwork provided they could detect no signs of foul play. It came to light years later that this duty was not carried out as thoroughly as expected when it was Harold Shipman who completed Form B. A third authority was to fill out Form F. They were to order another autopsy if they suspected that another exam was necessary. If this was not the case, they would order the cremation. This procedure was also passed along without the required amount of rigor. We are vulnerable when we're under the care of a medical professional. We need to be able to trust them and assume they only have the best of intentions for us. Through malpractice, malicious or unintentional, the person who has been entrusted to heal us can also take the form of the Grim Reaper in a lab coat. Doctors are human beings first, and just like the rest of us, they have emotions and shortcomings. As much as most of us would like to be our own doctors, most of us would not make it through the organic chemistry boot camp. All we can do is trust. March 24th, 1998. The Brook Practice was one of the institutions Harold Shipman utilized for Form C services. One member of the practice, Dr. Linda Reynolds, shared her concerns with Mr. John Pollard, the coroner for the Greater Manchester South District, about the quantity of Form Cs her firm was filling out for Shipman. By anyone's standards, the amount would have been considered immoderate. The Brook practice had three times as many patients as Shipman, and during the 3 months before Reynolds' report on Shipman, 14 of their patients passed away. During that time, Shipman submitted 16 Form C requests to the Brook practice. They were all cremations. A woman named Mrs. Deborah Bambroff was an undertaker and partner at Frank Massey and Sons Funeral Directors. She frequently attended to the funerals of Shipman's patients. At one point, she noticed some similarities among his patients. Female, lived alone, and were found dead at home. They were usually in good health. Shipman was usually present when they died or discovered their deaths. When they were found, they were fully clothed and seated, usually free of distress and in peace. They were dressed as one would be if they were expecting a visitor. John Pollard submitted a report to the Greater Manchester Police, with special attention to Chief Superintendent David Sykes and Detective Inspector David Smith. Smith spearheaded the investigation. Clearly, Smith was also under Shipman's spell, for he drew significant criticism for how he handled the case. He didn't take the charges seriously. He also didn't fully understand the implications of what Dr. Reynolds told him. He could have followed up or done some research on post-mortem medical protocol, but he didn't see the need to do so. There were cadavers in the morgue that had been patients of Shipman's, and Smith had the authority to order another autopsy and toxicology reports for both, but he saw no necessity in doing so. He was provided with death certificates, filled out by Shipman, but due to a clerical error at the registry office, he received a much lower number than Shipman completed, that being 20. As a result, he continued to underestimate the scale of Shipman's malfeasance. One Dr. Banks was a colleague and friend of Shipman's and was given a pile of death certificates filled out by Shipman. He only received 14. He didn't spot as many similarities in these cases and told Smith there was no reason for concern. He told him that two cases were similar, but that they didn't warrant an investigation. April 1st, 1998. Smith paid a visit to the Dukenfield Crematorium. It was the regional cremation facility where all of Shipman's patients were sent. While there, he could have inquired about the process of certifying cremations. Had he done so, he would have seen stacks of Form Bs filled out by Harold Shipman. Asking to look at the crematory register would have enabled him to examine the 11 cremated deaths he didn't know about. But again, he didn't inquire. A more incisive approach would have resulted in the disclosure that could have saved lives. April 15, 1998. Detective Inspector Smith and Chief Superintendent Sykes met to discuss the inquiry. Smith reported that there was no evidence proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that Dr. Harold Shipman was murdering his patients. Sykes gave his approval to close the investigation. With that as a conclusion, Smith didn't even so much as write a completed report. No interview with Shipman, no attempts to see if he had a criminal record involving controlled substances in a medical setting. Ageism may have factored into the failure of this inquiry. A rash of premature deaths among children would have resulted in far more urgency, and nobody would have accepted the non-committal conclusion of the investigation. Harold Shipman was aware of the investigation, and suddenly corpses and cremations dwindled in number with him as practitioner. The numbers would soon rise again, however. June 24th, 1998. 81-year-old Kathleen Grundy passed away. She was a patient of Harold Shipman's practice. Despite her age, she was mentally and physically active. She lived independently and seldom needed medical care. When she died, Shipman certified her death as being due to, quote, old age. If life is truly a rat race, she was a marathon runner, and there was no indication that she would expire so abruptly. Mrs. Grundy's daughter, Angela Woodruff, was a practicing lawyer. Naturally, she handled her mother's legal affairs, including her will, which listed Angela as the sole beneficiary of Kathleen's estate. One day, Angela received word that a new will had been drawn up without her knowledge and delivered to another law firm. The new will was completed on June 30, 1998, and curiously, the new and only beneficiary was Dr. Harold Shipman. Naturally, Angela was suspicious. She investigated the matter and, in doing so, paid a visit to the two individuals listed as witnesses on the document. On July 24th, she submitted a report to police in her district of Warwickshire. They turned it over to the Greater Manchester Police. When they examined the will, they realized that the doctor listed as sole beneficiary was the same doctor they investigated for his prodigious output of cadavers. August 1st. A search warrant was issued so that officers could search Shipman's practice and home. They seized a typewriter and a large cache of medical records. As the search was underway, Mrs. Grundy's body was exhumed for another autopsy. A toxicology procedure was carried out, and among the findings was the presence of an opiate. They couldn't determine what kind and how much, however. More tests would have to be run to get a clear picture. August 10th, the Greater Manchester Police were notified by the Home Office Drugs Inspectorate about Shipman's history with drug-related offenses. Shipman was questioned about those charges on August 14th. Following this, a re-examination of 19 deaths certified by Shipman was ordered. Relatives of the deceased were interviewed about whether they had concerns about the circumstances under which their loved ones met their ends. An additional 9 deaths were examined that had fallen through the cracks due to the registry office's error when Detective Smith alone was handling the case. August 26th, a forensic documents examiner analyzed Kathleen Grundy's updated will. It came to light that Mrs. Grundy's signature was forged, and that the model of typewriter used for the document was most likely of the same Brother brand specimen that was seized in Shipman's office. August 28th. Investigators were informed that the opiate found in Mrs. Grundy's remains was morphine and administered at those levels was sufficient to result in an overdose for someone of Mrs. Grundy's proportions. September 7th, Harold Shipman was arrested on suspicion of causing the death of Mrs. Kathleen Grundy and for the forgery of her will. Authorities would go on to order the exhumation of bodies of Shipman's patients that had not been cremated. By February 1999, Shipman would be charged with 14 more murders. Though it had never been officially prescribed to these patients, their remains presented with traces of morphine. The following is a partial transcript of a police interview that was conducted with Harold Shipman following his arrest. Police interviewer, going back to the computer medical records which we will show you, the entry for Mrs. Grundy's visit on the 9th of June, can you tell me why there is no reference there to taking any blood product? Shipman, normally blood results came back 2 days later. Police interviewer, why was there no actual update? Shipman, I've got no explanation. Police, could it have been an oversight? Shipman, it could have been. I don't know why there is no entry. Police, you said that on the 23rd, when she came to see you in the surgery, you were concerned that she felt unwell. Do you recall saying that? Shipman, I think the thing was she was frail and elderly. Police, is that from a visual observation? Shipman, yes, she didn't look as well as she normally did. Police, were there any other symptoms? Shipman, nothing more than just the visual observations. Police, now, at the bottom of the page, the entry is actually dated the 24th of June. Can I suggest to you that this is a backdated entry? It was made, perhaps, on the morning of the 24th of June. It actually relates to the visit made by Mrs. Grundy to your surgery on the 23rd. You claim that entry refers to the morning home visit on the 24th. There is no mention of a home visit. You claimed it was an error. Shipman, it's an error. Police, there is no mention in that entry, which you claim to be that date, about taking a blood sample from her. I can see what you were pointing at, HBESR. It does not actually say you took a blood sample from her. Shipman, it's not the custom of most general practitioners to write, I have taken a blood sample which would consist of this, this, and this. Most general practitioners just write down what the blood test is they are doing. Police, can I suggest to you that that entry dated the 24th is actually referring to the visit by Mrs. Grundy on 23rd? The sole purpose, from what you tell us, of the visit on the 24th was simply to take a blood sample. It was not check her pulse or her chest or her abdomen and other things. Was that the case? Shipman, no. Police, where do you keep dangerous drugs in your practice? Shipman, I do not have any DDAs on the premises, in my car. I don't have a dangerous drugs book. Police, that being the case, and you don't keep dangerous drugs on the premises, where do you access dangerous drugs to treat terminally ill patients? Shipman, I would issue a prescription to the relatives, or in an emergency situation, I would issue the prescription, pick it up from the chemist, and deliver directly to the house. And that is the only time I would touch them. The giving of the drugs would be down to the district nurse, the Macmillan nurse, or whoever it was. Police, what happens, say, if one of your patients dies from a terminal illness? You are aware that they have whatever it is in the way of dangerous drugs on them. What happens to those drugs? Shipman, drugs are usually destroyed by the district nurse in the presence of the patient's relatives. I would never take drugs away. Police, what drugs would you routinely carry with you day to day? Shipman, antibiotic samples, sleeping tablets, some Valium, centimetrium, diuretic, plus others. Police, let's move on to Mrs. Grundy's will. I mentioned to you earlier on in the will that you were named as the sole beneficiary of her estate, all her monies, etc., which you said came as a complete surprise to you. Shipman, yes? Police, that will was found to be forged. The signatures, Spencer and Hutchinson, were forgeries. They were not the signatures which they made in your surgery on the 9th of June. There is also on the will form, the document itself, an indentation of the practiced forgery. The practiced signatures, shall we say, of Kathleen Grundy. What I am saying to you is the will is a complete and utter forgery. Do you have any comments to make about that? Shipman, no. I have no comment to make. Police. The will was received at Hamilton's solicitors with an accompanying letter, which we'll show you. We'll show you the will. As I mentioned earlier, there was an existing comprehensive will made out in 1986, which was held by Kathleen Grundy's solicitors. Have you seen that will form before? Shipman, no. Police. When Spencer and Hutchinson signed in your surgery as witnesses, did you see or notice any part of the form? The reasons why I ask is that one of those persons remembers seeing the words at the top, last will and testament. Shipman. What I saw was Mrs. Grundy holding my pen, signing, and then I saw the two people signing. Police. I'll pass you a letter. It's dated the 28th of June. It was received by Hamilton's on the 30th. It's marked D-22. What knowledge do you have of that letter? Shipman, none. Police. The letters in the will were all typed on your brother typewriter. Can you account for that? Shipman, no. Police. The letter signed S. Smith doesn't come with an address. Mrs. Smith, as far as we are concerned, does not exist. The letter was clearly sent after Mrs. Grundy's death. Can you account for that, Doctor? Shipman, I cannot. Police interviewer, who would have had access to your typewriter after Mrs. Grundy's death? Shipman, the question is, when was it returned to the surgery, and that I do not know. Police, you mention, you allege, Mrs. Grundy borrowed the typewriter on two or three occasions. You don't know when. You don't know who may have witnessed her borrowing the typewriter. We're talking here about a lady who's 81, who we would imagine have some difficulty carrying a typewriter. I am asking, who would have used your typewriter after the 24th of June to type that letter? Shipman, I am saying that I don't know. Police, this was a typewriter that was kept in your surgery. Shipman, this was a typewriter that was loaned out to Mrs. Grundy on two or three occasions. Police, this was a typewriter that was used to produce that letter after her death. Shipman, I am saying I am not sure when the typewriter was returned to my surgery. Police, where was the typewriter on the 24th of June? Shipman, I have no idea. Police, can I put it directly to you, Doctor, that you forged... You produced the letters of this will from your typewriter in the hope of benefiting from Mrs. Grundy's estate? Shipman, is that a question or a statement? Police, I put it to you that that is the case. Shipman, that is not the case. Police, I put it to you that you are responsible. You are the author of the letters, and you manufactured the will. You forged the signatures. Shipman, and I am saying I didn't do that. Police, Mrs. Grundy was exhumed on the 1st of August this year, and there were extensive tests, toxicology. I'll quote what the forensic scientist said to us. Her death is consistent with the use or administration of a significant quantity of morphine or diamorphine, and similar values have been seen in fatalities attributed to morphine overdoses. Do you have any comments to make about that? Shipman's solicitor. I think we need to go back to some earlier entries in the GP notes. Police. Do you want to look at them? Shipman's solicitor. Yep. If you go back to the entry 12 of the 10th, 96, here I commented, IBS, again, odd pupils, small constipated drug abuse. I have written, at her age, codeine, meaning I am wondering if she is taking codeine tablets. Wait and see. So then in July, I deliberately made the comment that she is having these IBS attacks every day. Pupils, small. Dry mouth. Possible drug abuse again. Denies taking any drug other than for IBS. I am sure you are well aware that drugs like morphine, heroin, pethidine, all cause constipation. All cause small pupils. My comments on the 26th of the 11th. IBS again. Should I do a blood test and check the urine? I am sure you are aware to do a blood test and check urine against the patient's consent is not a legal event. Really difficult as she denies everything. She is not really at risk. She is not an intravenous user as far as I was aware. I am not sure. Still, clinically, nothing of note to confirm my suspicions. Wait and see. So, over that period of time, I wondered very seriously whether this lady was taking drugs other than which I had prescribed. And I will come back to the osteoporosis, because that is what I believed she was doing. I believed she was taking something other than what I had prescribed for the osteoporosis. I would only be guessing where she got it from. Police, are you seriously suggesting that Mrs. Grundy, a well-respected lady who had a decent life, inflicted a fatal overdose upon herself? Are you really suggesting that to us? Shipman, and I ask whether the house was searched. Police, yes. There were no drugs whatsoever that could cause a fatality, according to the findings we have got. Shipman, solicitor. Well, when was it searched? Police, I haven't got those dates to hand of the search. Shipman, that's quite important. Police, but are you suggesting, doctor, that... Shipman, I am not suggesting anything. I am just saying my fears and worries of this lady at that time. Police, I have given you the cause of death, a fatal overdose of morphine or diamorphine, and I have asked you to comment. Shipman, and I have commented. I have said that I had my suspicions that she was abusing a narcotic of some sort, or at least taking a narcotic of some sort over a period of a year or so. He was referring to an earlier GP who wrote about her medication. I am not suggesting she took drugs every day, far from it. But the scenario was there. She did have drugs available, and she may well have accidentally given herself an overdose. Police. The scenario is this. You tell us, are you involved in some aging survey? Shipman. I'm not telling you I am not involved in an aging survey. I am involved with care of elderly patients as recommended by the government in their Health of the Nation document, which involves looking after elderly patients. Police. I suggest to you that you have injected Mrs. Grundy with a fatal overdose of morphine. Shipman. No. And you tell me that people in Hyde don't have access to drugs. I think you should talk to your drugs squad. Police. Is it not a coincidence or significant that you are the sole beneficiary, or would have been a sole beneficiary, of a forged will? There is nobody else who could have sent that letter who had an interest in the estate of Mrs. Grundy other than yourself after her death. Is that not the case? Shipman, solicitor. It could have been anyone with a deranged mind who could have sent that. Police. Not with the doctor's typewriter, they couldn't. And who would have been aware that the doctor was to benefit from the estate? And who would have been aware that the will had been deposited with Hamilton Wards when the original will had been with the daughter? Would you agree that there is no medical history which would support Mrs. Grundy's very sudden death? Shipman, people do die suddenly of old age. They just wear out. Police, would it not have been of interest to you professionally, given that she was one of your patients involved in the aging survey? Shipman, it was the Health of the Nation project for over 75s, if you are going to talk about a specialized survey. I was not taking part in a specialized survey. We are just looking after elderly in the way we do it. So no, I don't think it was peculiar not to ask for a post-mortem. Police, you're looking at me again, doctor. Shipman, so is your colleague. Police, we'll ask you a question regarding the drugs. You don't keep drugs in your surgery, is that correct? Shipman, I keep no drugs. You were talking about controlled drugs in my surgery, my car, or at home. Police, I think at that point we'll conclude things. September 29th, the National Health Service Tribunal ruled that Shipman would be suspended from practice. October 5th, 1999, the criminal trial of Harold Shipman began. He was charged with 15 counts of murder and one charge of forgery. He pled not guilty to all charges. The findings of the toxicology reports were an ace in the prosecution's sleeve, since only one of Shipman's victims had actually been prescribed morphine in an official capacity. Witnesses testified that they found a patient dead immediately after one of Shipman's house calls. Another reported that she paid a visit to one of his patients and that when she encountered him in their living room, he was startled but soon regained his composure and informed the woman that his patient had a sudden stroke while she was out of the room. Speculation had it that Shipman would administer heroin or diamorphine because it was more effective as an execution agent and, combined with pure morphine, it would cause asphyxiation, leading shortly to death. Shipman acquired heroin by writing fake prescriptions and keeping records sparsely. The drug is supposed to be submitted for destruction in the event of a surplus. Shipman once received an order of 12,000 milligrams in the name of a recently deceased patient. That amount was potent enough to kill 360 people. In some cases, he prescribed diamorphine for patients he killed. One attempt he made at covering his tracks was to diagnose the patients with various illnesses and medical events, like diabetes, heart disease, heart attacks, pneumonia, and strokes. The problem was, there was seldom any indication that the patient's symptoms could have caused death. As far as death from old age goes, it is attributable to instant multi-organ failure. The process can take years. There was no evidence of this in any of his victims. His credibility was further fractured when witnesses recalled that his examination of his patient's remains was brief, almost cursory. It was only borderline tactile, examining vital signs that would be obvious to someone who has no medical training, but would be insufficient compared to the symptoms a licensed physician is supposed to look for. Shipman was so cold-hearted, he was in a great hurry to get an ambulance and shuffle the patient off so he could have them processed as quickly as possible. That is when ambulances were called. The patient's phone records were examined, revealing that it was more likely a hearse than an ambulance that would have pulled up in the driveway. He didn't show much sensitivity to the bereaved. He would be impatient and brusque, even going as far as to tell one grieving relative that he, quote, had the living to take care of. Evidently, he viewed any kind of post-mortem protocol to be a chore after he had gotten what he wanted from the patient. It was his handling of the demise of Kathleen Grundy that brought about his downfall. He got her signature for some paperwork that would be submitted for approval by a medical research program. Speculation has it that this was how he found a way to forge her signature. The revised copy of her will with Harold Shipman as sole beneficiary was submitted to the law firm Hamilton Ward 2 hours before her death. The closest thing to an admission of guilt was made to a district nurse when Shipman discussed Mrs. Grundy's death with her. Facetiously, he said Grundy should be cremated because, quote, you can't exhume ashes. The defense was not able to summon a strong enough argument for Shipman's acquittal. The claims that overprescribing opiates and administering them in excessive quantities were the result of honest mistakes didn't cut it. He also claimed that Kathleen Grundy borrowed his typewriter to drop the new version of her will. Why would a doctor with a busy private practice lend a patient his only word processing device? The notion that she would bequeath to him the entirety of her estate didn't add up, either, since she had children and grandchildren who had been listed as beneficiaries in the previous draft. Why would she leave the entirety of 386,000 pounds to her doctor? Harold Shipman was found guilty on all counts. January 31st, 2000. Harold Shipman received 15 life sentences for the murders and an additional 4 years for forgery. The sentences were commuted to a whole life tariff, meaning he was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. February 11th, 2000. Harold Shipman was removed from the General Medical Council's register. In other words, his license to practice medicine was, as of that date, null and void. The families of all the deceased, not just those of the patients whose murders had been proven with evidence during Shipman's trial, demanded further action. On September 21st, 2000, the Secretary of State announced that an inquiry would be conducted. The Shipman Inquiry, as it was called, was headed by Dame Janet Smith. The purpose was to not just examine Shipman's activities, but to reveal how the health care and legal systems could have enabled him to commit mass murder. The approach to investigating the matter by police would also be examined. Shipman refused to participate in the inquiry. It came to light that he may have stolen 10,000 pounds worth of jewelry from his victims, since a cache of jewelry was found in his garage. January 13, 2004. Harold Shipman was found dead in his prison cell. He had committed suicide by hanging himself with his bed sheets. Reactions to his suicide were mixed. The Daily Mirror newspaper branded him a, quote, cold coward. They criticized the prison for allowing it to happen, allegedly. Other reactions were celebratory. Relatives of his victims felt cheated since he neither confessed nor provided assistance in the Shipman inquiry. The only clue to his motive was he told his probation officer that he was considering suicide because his wife could collect his National Health Service pension. After a brief private ceremony attended only by his wife and children, Shipman was cremated. Harold Shipman is considered to be one of the most prolific serial killers in history. Based on the findings of the Shipman Inquiry, he is responsible for the deaths of an estimated 250 victims. Possibly more. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Bye for now.